The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Denise McKnight. I'm a shareholder at Scheckman Marks DeVore, which is a local CPA firm located just a few blocks away at 20th and Market. This morning's event is part of the Free Library's new Leading Voices series, which features great conversations with top minds in business. Leading Voices is sponsored by my firm, Scheckman Marks DeVore, and by Brandywine Realty Trust. This morning's breakfast was generously provided by the Four Seasons Hotel Philadelphia. Please join me in thanking Brandywine, Scheckman, and the Four Seasons for their support. The Free Library carries out critical work each and every day to advance literacy, guide learning, and inspire curiosity in Greater Philadelphia at its 54 locations. They are proud to provide extensive resources for our region's business community, from online databases to small business workshops and their new Leading Voices series. According to a study conducted by Fells Institute, nearly 9,000 small business owners were able to start, grow, or enhance their companies in 1 year with the help of the Free Library, helping our city's small business community thrive. If you value the library as much as I do, please make a gift of support to the Free Library Foundation, which helps make possible many of the library's incredible programs, like Leading Voices. Visit freelibrary.org/support to learn more and make your gift. It is now my pleasure to introduce this morning's speaker. Current president at Barnard College, former professor at Harvard Business School, member of the board of directors at Goldman Sachs, and mother of three, Deborah Spar understands how difficult it can be for a woman to achieve professionally while balancing the concerns of family and pursuit of an ideal personal life. She is the author of 6 books, including Ruling the Waves, A Cycle of Invention, Chaos, and Wealth, From the Compass to the Internet, and numerous articles. In Wonder Women, Ms. Spar takes a wise and worthy look at how American women's lives have and have not changed over the last 50 years, tactfully navigating heated debates while also narrating the story of her own successes and roadblocks over the years. She examines the new issues that confront women and provides a roadmap for the future. The Washington Post praises Wonder Woman as an interesting and powerful observation on the evolution of feminism. Ms. Spar will be interviewed today by 6ABC's own Wonder Woman, Action News Morning Edition editor, Tamla Edwards. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Deborah Spar and Tamla Edwards.
Good morning and welcome. It's great to see all of you here. It's warm. We'll have some feisty debate in here while everybody out there is cold. And so first of all, I wanted to start off, and Deborah and I talked a little bit about this backstage. If you're here, you probably have been paying attention to a lot of the debate around various topics on this issue. We've heard from Sheryl Sandberg saying, don't leave before you leave, lean in. We've heard from Anne-Marie Slaughter saying, the system is rigged. We need you to change some of the government and workplace issues. As I read your book, it was interesting because it was a little bit of a different argument to me. You were saying the head leads the rest of you. Your expectations lead the rest of you. All of this is about where you set the bar, not so much these other arguments. So tell me a little bit about that as you tell people a little bit about the book.
Okay, thank you. And thank you all for being here. This is wonderful, and even though it is freezing out, it's great to be here. So it's an interesting moment in time right now because I think we are seeing this surge of interest around women's issues, women in the workplace, women in society. And I think it's great that we are having this mini explosion of books on this topic. We need more. You know, I think there's way more room in this debate, and as many people have pointed out, Anne-Marie, Sheryl, and I, although our books are very different, we're very similar people socioeconomically, so we really do need to broaden the debate, you know, even much further from where it is right now. But my book is something I've been working on for at least 7 years. So it was a long time in the making. And it's really a book about expectations. And it was very much sort of a personal journey to write the book, to think about, you know, as I've gotten older, watching the women I've known in my life and the students I've had over many, many years sort of not making it. And you know, it took me a long time to sort of realize that people I'd gone to college with who were every bit as smart and every bit as ambitious and every bit as competitive over the years were not in the workforce. And students I taught at Harvard Business School for decades who were super smart and super competitive and super ambitious were having very different careers than their male counterparts. And I tried to figure out why. And part of it is clearly that the workplace is tougher for women. And I think that's something that Cheryl spends a lot of time describing in her book. And part of it is that we don't have the social structures of daycare and better parental support that we wish we had. And that's a lot of what Anne-Marie talks about in her book. But my book really sits in the middle there and is broader. Because really what I'm saying is that women are not living up to our expectations, in large part because we've set the expectations too high. And I'm not saying that at all, that, you know, women can't be as successful as we thought they might be. It's just that we as a society and as individuals, I think, really do believe that we can have it all. And I don't know who came up with the phrase having it all, but it's a really bad idea. And we need to ban it from the vernacular, because whoever looks at men and says, does he have it all? We don't ask that question of men, because we implicitly assume that men make trade-offs. And when you're evaluating Jamie Dimon as the president of J.P. Morgan, nobody ever asks, and is he a good dad? But every time there's a woman in these positions, we always ask, does she have kids? Is she married? Is she thin? How does she look? Is she nice? Does she bake cupcakes? And it's that set of expectations that I think is really at the root cause of many of the issues that women face, and is particularly the root cause of why so many women feel guilty and like failures all the time.
Well, as I was reading the book, I wonder, you know, often when you're getting dressed, men will say to you, no guy cares about the hair bow or if your jacket matches. You're dressing for the girls. Yeah. They're paying attention. And I wonder that as I read the book as well, because you chart out the history, that it wasn't enough that you could get a job. It wasn't enough that you could be a mother. Somewhere the pressure came in to be a size 00, to read Martha Stewart, all the magazines. And I remember a colleague at Time once where she did the ham, and she actually went and got the little grass and put the ham on the grass to serve it for Easter dinner. That all of these things...
You laugh, but you've
all
done
but
that.
She did. Right. She told the whole office. This was the Pentagon defense reporter.
Right.
That there is this pressure, and you wonder as you read the book, where did it come from? Because guys are not looking at... You know, they're just looking at Kim Kardashian's boobs. They're not saying, how is she a size zero? We're saying that.
Right.
Where did that come from?
You know, I spent a lot of time for this book, partly because it was fun, going back and reading popular magazines, watching television shows or reading about shows and movies. And nobody ever sat in a corner office and said, how can we really torture women so that we make it impossible for them to succeed? I don't believe that there's sort of a media conspiracy. But what I think happened is as a result of lots and lots of good intentions, we wound up giving girls and then young women this totally confusing sense of reality. And think about how we raise girls. And I don't know whether this is biology or socialization. We're constantly saying to girls, and particularly since the feminist revolution, you can be whatever you want. You can be a leader. You can play football. You can do better than your brothers in math. But at the same time, we're also saying, but you should be a ballerina. And I'm going to take you to Claire's and cover you with glitter and makeup and nail polish. So boys don't get that same breadth of expectations. I think at least they rarely do. And I think these expectations were particularly pronounced for women of my generation. I was born in 1963. So right at sort of the peak of the feminist movement. So I think my mother's generation, for all the right reasons, was saying to girls of my age, be whatever you want. You can be an astronaut. You can be a lawyer. And the problem is we didn't hear that as you can. We heard it as you should. And so what really was designed as opportunities began to feel like expectations. And even now, if you look at the messages we give young girls, I mean, they're empowering, but they're horrifying. We're teaching girls to be leaders when they're in their teens, which is all good, and we have a fabulous leadership center at Barnard, but let's think about it. Most 16-year-olds aren't really going to be leaders. At the same time, we're also saying, and you should be an athlete. The great thing in my life was at least I could never go to gym. I could, you know, bow out of gym and use that extra time. But now we're saying to young girls, and you should be athletic, and you should be good at math, and you should be pretty. And so we are hearing this stuff. And then I think you're exactly right. We then begin to torture ourselves. And we've all had those Martha Stewart moments more than we want to admit. But I think when you read women's magazines, they're all about trying harder. You know, thinner thighs in 30 days. Cook the perfect Thanksgiving meal.
That doesn't help the thinner thighs.
Pumpkin carving. I know, it's totally contradictory. And when you read literature that's designed more for men, it has less to do with these aspirations. I mean, some of it you get in the fitness magazines, but it's really just in that one smaller segment.
As I was thinking about this, I interviewed Barbara Walters not too long ago here, and I'm going to attribute this quote to her. It may have been somebody else, but she said her understanding was, you know, wife, mother, career girl. You can do two out of three, but you can't do all three.
Yeah.
Is she right? Does that still hold now?
I'd say partially. I think you can do all three, but you can't do all three perfectly. And I think that's the problem, that we hold ourselves to these expectations across all spheres. And so while women have surged into the workplace, which is a wonderful thing, we've created expectations of workplace success, but we haven't done anything to rejigger our expectations of home front success. You cannot be the same kind of mother if you're CEO of a Fortune 500 corporation as you could be if you were a stay-at-home mom. That doesn't mean it's impossible, but something's got to give. And I say this, my daughter's getting her early decision, college decision today, and I'm not home, you know, and I wish I were home. And, you know, it would be better for her if I were home today. So I think we have to acknowledge these trade-offs, and part of this goes back to, you know, I don't buy into the theory that women are just naturally catty towards one another, but I do think we have a tendency not to reveal our own vulnerabilities, our mistakes, our mess-ups. And one of the things I try and do in the book is reveal some of, you know, the greatest screw-ups, bad moments of my life. Because I think if those of us who have been lucky enough to be able to do the wife, mother, career girl thing, if we don't fess up about, A, how hard it is, and B, the mistakes we've made and the things we've done badly, I think we're selling younger generation of women a bill of goods. We're selling them a myth.
You go through various areas in the book, all leading to Kill Charlie, the image of the 60s girl, you know, the Charlie girl who can do it all. And let's go through some of those areas. One of them, you talk about marriage, and a woman tiredly says, we got equality in the workplace, but we didn't get equality at home. And I think that's an issue that when I do these events, women keep coming back to. The Arlie Hochschild's second shift, no matter what's going on at work, when I come home, my husband's fine leaving the laundry, leaving the dirty dishes, not checking the homework, but it's me. You even talk about women like Naomi Wolf, who thought she had an enlightened guy, but then found herself back with, after a couple of diapers, he was like, we're good.
Yeah.
So what? How does a modern woman who wants to have a family, even if she tamps down the expectations, you just get so gosh darn exhausted. Right. How do you make it happen?
Right. Now, I was saying this. I was interviewed by a very wonderful young feminist who was saying, you know, how did you deal with overt sexism in the workplace? And I said, and I know this wasn't the answer she wanted, I said, it wasn't the sexism that got to me. It was the exhaustion. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that really is the modern woman's nemesis. And, you know, this goes back to, A, I think just acknowledging that it's hard. Yeah. And as I argue in the book, at some point, it's just the basic math. If you have a couple and they're both, let's go to the extreme, investment bankers, and they're each working 60, 70, 80-hour weeks, having to get on a plane at a moment's notice, they're not going to be able to have kids in a productive way. Something has to give. So either they don't have kids, which I think is an option we really have to talk about. We still sort of idolize the woman as mother in a way that's quite problematic. I think we have to be more open about saying many people may choose not to have kids. And if you look at some of the most powerful women out there right now, many of them are not moms. And I think we need to legitimate and validate that choice. Many of them, and this is really sort of a dirty little secret, many powerful women with kids have stay-at-home husbands. Mm-hmm. Or husbands who have taken a more flexible career path. Jodi Kantor wrote a very interesting piece for The Times about it this past weekend. Women don't brag about their stay-at-home husbands. And I think, again, we play into the myth that our husbands are hardworking and, you know, virile. And I think we need to brag more about, you know, my husband is working from home, or, you know, he's the one doing the part-time work. That's another option. There is also the option, which, again, is rare in this country, much more commonplace in other parts of the world, of having our in-laws, I know this sounds horrifying, move in with us, or, you know, move next door. This is a very common model in places like India, where there's actually many more women in positions of power in sectors like finance. It's because they actually do live close to extended family. We all tend to, as Americans, we move away from our families, and we lose that link that really is crucial if you're going to be trying to have a family and jobs. So I think there are ways to do the wife-mother career, but you can't do it with both parents working killer hours and hope to be anything like a quality parent. Something has to give.
Which leads to, for some women, the decision is, okay, fine, I've met my spouse in graduate school, on the job, I'm going to take a step back. You note at various points in the book, women you know, who that ends up being a dangerous decision. The guy runs off with another graduate assistant. The marriage just doesn't work out, and the wife is left to figure it out on her own. But then you're kind of stuck. Somebody's got to step back. A lot of young women say, you know what, I'd like it to be me.
Right.
But when you do, it's hard to get back on the ramp and get paid what you would have been paid. And it's hard to know, is this guy going to stick it out? Or in 20 years, I'm going to say, I was at home while you were running around with Susie. What does a woman do?
Right. Well, I think this is a very depressing answer to your question. Because, you know, I think everybody hopefully goes into marriage hoping for the best. Mm-hmm. And I'd hate to advise young women, you know, presume your guy's going to cheat on you and leave you. Because that's it's a bad way to go into marriage. But I do think women need to realize that the on-ramps don't work. We did an event at Barnard last week with Sylvia Ann Hewlett, who was the person who created the concept of the on-ramp. And I was worried. I was doing the interview, and I asked her, I said, so everything I know says that the on-ramps don't work. Were you wrong? And she said, yeah. She said, we really hoped that the on-ramps would work, but history has shown us they don't. There are a couple of companies that have done a good job. The accounting firms, interestingly, seem to be leading the pack and creating pathways back for women. But I think women have to be realistic. If you're going to get off a fast-track job for any more than a couple of months, it's going to be hard to come back. Not impossible, but hard. And I think women should at least, if they're going to make those choices, make them with the knowledge that they may have second careers that are very different. It's much easier to get back on if you keep even a small toe in the workplace.
So it sounds like part-time. You should be thinking, I'm going to step back and consult. I'm going to step back and go part-time. Not, I'm going to go home, ladies, you fight it out on the corner suite.
That's right. That's right. You're not, you know, the more involved you can remain, the better chance you will have. And, you know, again, this is an area in which I think other parts of the world do a better job. I've done a couple of talks in Hong Kong for the women in finance organizations there. And for whatever reasons, the professional organizations there include women who were in the professions and then are home. And they seem to do a much better job of remaining deeply connected. The working moms go to the same organizations mm-hmm. as the non-working moms. And they both seem to validate each other's choices, whereas here, I don't think I've ever been to a professional women's organization that included women who weren't working at the time. So this does go back to some of the cattiness. I think here we tend to have this sort of nasty competition between women who work and, you know, women who don't. And that doesn't do any of us any good.
You go out on a limb in the book when you talk about fertility. You know, we all see the pictures of Halle Berry having a baby at 46.
Yeah, don't believe those.
And everybody makes it seem like, oh, yeah. You know, you just go to the right doctor and it'll be fine. And you say, no, if you want kids, except you need to try to do this in your 20s.
Yeah. So I said this to a group at Washington the other day, which was largely young women, and I think I freaked out every person in the room.
Did you hear that in the corner over there?
Yes, I'm going to freak out several here. So my last book was on the fertility industry, so I actually do feel very confident saying this. Women's fertility peaks at 27. It falls off a cliff at 35. Yes, there are women who can have babies into their 40s, but they are rare. And most of the stories you hear about starlets, you know, giving birth painlessly at 42 are lies, and they're not their eggs. They're donor eggs, which is definitely an option, but it's complicated, it's expensive, and the success rates are not that high. I gave another talk recently, which horrified me. Two women came up to me and said they had heard me speak 10 years ago, and they instantly raced out and tried to get pregnant. I'm delighted to report that they did both have children, but one woman said it took her 7 years and $500,000. So, sorry, those of you, I'm not saying to go out and have sex immediately, but just be aware of the fact that, for, you know, Mother Nature is unfair. Men can have babies much later in their life than women can, and I think, again, people just need to be aware of that, and also to be aware of other options. So it, you know, I think, again, it's fine to say, you know, having children was not part of my life. I had many other wonderful parts, but having children was not part of them. And my third child is adopted, and so I always feel compelled to tell people adoption is a very wonderful option. And don't take that off the table.
And from the book, she sounds like a delightful girl.
She's the one whose early decision decision I'm going to miss today. So
yeah, if you're putting,
many bad mother points.
If you're putting all these pieces together, I need to try to have the children earlier. I need to be thinking about my expectations. I need to be thinking about these things with my marriage. Keep a foot in part-time. What does this look like? Does it mean you say to yourself, I don't need to be the CEO of the company. I want to find the right job that gives me some flexibility. Is that the big expectation that we should be changing?
Yes and no. And you know, I want to be very careful here. I'm not saying give up on the CEO job. If what you want is the CEO job, go for the CEO job. But don't expect that you're going to be president of the PTA. And don't expect that you're going to be making those beautiful pumpkins on the cover of Martha Stewart Living.
You can hire somebody.
Or you can say, we don't do pumpkins in my household because mommy's the CEO. You know, so, and that goes back to your housekeeping question that I didn't quite answer. And by the same token, I think it also means that not everybody has to be the CEO. And I think it is a useful exercise for young women and young men to say, you know, if I do want the relationship and the devoted family life, you know, are there some careers or some subfields within careers that will give me more flexibility than others? And I think law is an interesting one. A lot of women go into law, and huge numbers of women leave law. And I think what we're seeing is that there are parts of law or areas of law that are very, very tough. You know, if you are a corporate lawyer and you bill hours and you work for clients, you're not going to have a lot of control over your schedule. Interestingly, if you're a judge, you work 9 to 5. Now, a judge is not a slacker job. It's not a second best job, but it is a job that gives you more hourly control than being a corporate litigator. In the field of medicine, where women have done quite well, there are certain areas of medicine that are much more flexible. Anesthesiology, you have predictable hours. Emergency room medicine, interestingly, because you would think emergency, but you have set hours as an emergency room physician, whereas as an OBGYN, you actually don't. So I think there's a little bit of an element of political correctness that we don't want to say to young women, you know, shape your career with an eye towards having kids. And I think Cheryl falls into some of this. I would say shape your career if you want kids and a career. Shape your career with an eye to having a family, because some areas will just enable this much more than will others.
My father begged me to be an anesthesiologist. He was like, you'll go home for dinner. I'm like, I don't like blood. I don't think it's going to work. One of the areas that you talk about where obviously the freedom came into play was sexuality. And that's very personal and very shaping in who we are as women, who we are in relationships. You tell about a coffee klatch you do in your home, and it was really a sad anecdote where you talk to the young women about their expectations. There's a lot of hooking up. There's a lot of doing things provocatively because men like them. I kiss girls at parties because the guys like it. There's a lot of sex. And when you say, well, has anybody here had an orgasm? Nobody had. This is the next generation. What did that tell you? If your whole thing is about setting your expectations, decide what you want. What did that tell you about what this next generation wants or what they're getting into?
You know, I always feel hopelessly middle-aged when I talk about this topic. And I really thought I would be beaten up by my students for putting this argument out there. But I haven't been. You know, what I'm hearing from young women is that they're participating in the hookup culture because it's the social norm. You know, and let's be honest, you know, when we're 18, 19, 20, most of us are very heavily influenced by whatever the societal norm is. And if the societal norm is you go out and have anonymous sex with people you don't really ever plan to see again, that's what you do. That's what is the dominant norm now, particularly for the first couple of years of college. And then I think also for the first couple of years after college. But what I'm hearing from young women is that the hookup, you know, they're hooking up because they feel it's what they should do, but they really all want to get married and have kids. And so they're sort of presuming that they can hook up for 5, 7, 8 years, and then at some point they just stop hooking up and they find Mr. Right. Now, I hope that happens for them, but it's a little risky. And just to set the record straight, I didn't ask them if they had orgasms, because that would have been a terrifying question for me to ask, but it was... It was one of the young women, when I pulled them together, who's, you know, after 3 hours of these sort of, you know, very explicit conversations, she looked to the other young women in the group and she said, so have any of you ever had an orgasm? And no one said yes. And then they sort of ruminated on it. They sort of said, well, that's weird. You know, and they asked me how to do this, at which point I just sort of said, I am not going there. This is way above or below my pay grade. But I did venture the thought that it probably helps if you actually like the guy. And that was a bit of a revelation to them. And I do think that's, you know, it does make me sad, because I think, you know, that sort of first love and first intimacy and first experiences with sexuality should be something really special. And then I suspect that having good first experiences translates to, you know, a lifetime of good experiences. And I think that they're missing that.
That led me to a second personal question. It wasn't necessarily in the book. But is this part of the pornification of the culture, and does that work against women? I mean, when you've got grandmas in stripper heels and getting Brazilian waxes and being told, this is what you have to do.
Yeah.
A lot of young people are learning about sex from porn and being told, this is how you do it. And there doesn't seem to be a counteracting, okay, this is silly, we're not doing this.
Yeah, yeah. And this is something I think that also affects young men in ways that we're not really talking about. But this is like the worst thing for an academic to do, because I'm going to make an argument based on one anecdote. So bear that in mind. But there was a very interesting article in the student newspaper at Middlebury College, where my son is a student. And Middlebury is, you know, like many great colleges in the country, you know, full of bright, energetic young people, and a total hookup culture. And the newspaper report mentioned that the college clinic was seeing a real increase in men dealing with impotence. Now, these are 19-year-old men. They're not supposed to be impotent. And they were seeing enough of a spike that it made the newspaper, and they were arguing it was because the guys were watching so much porn that their expectations of how they should be performing were really proving problematic. And I'm sure that's equally true for girls. And again, anecdotally, you just hear that. If what you know about sex is what you've watched on the internet, and they're all watching a huge amount of internet porn, and they're you know, they're going to the how-tos on the website, you know, you're going to get a very distorted view of what really should be something you kind of figure out on your own.
Let's talk a little bit about companies, because you say it's up to the companies to figure out what women are good, give them the tools, and let them do it. Like decide that all of these things matter. If risk aversion is something that women are good at, say that this is a priority. If collaboration is something women are good at, say it's a priority. How do you get a company to do that? If it's a long-standing old boy, you know, you're on the board of Goldman Sachs. How do you get them to say, you know what, a little risk aversion and collaboration would be good?
So this is a tough one and a crucial one, because I think many, many companies now, and I'm talking here, having spent a lot of time at Harvard Business School working with a lot of companies, they know they need more women in their ranks. And I think it's reached a point now, it's not just, oh my gosh, we have to check that box. You know, I think many of the folks at the top, most of whom are male, are really disturbed by the fact that they look around the boardroom and it is all still male with one or two exceptions. They want more women in the ranks. They're losing lots of money because they're investing in young women, because women are still very, you know, quite highly represented at the entry rank, at the entry level. So companies are investing in them, and then they're not reaping the benefit of the investment because the women are not reaching the top. So they want to improve, but they're not actually evaluating women and men in the way that might make it easier for women to move through the ranks. So I think it's just sort of long-term pestering that we have to engage in. In, you know, it's interesting, Twitter has been through a lot of, you know, public scrutiny the past few months. You know, no women in the board, no women in the top ranks. And they yelled and screamed and fought. And, gee, it turns out that Marjorie Scardino was actually a fine board member. They hadn't thought of her, and then they began to think of her. So I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done. Most companies have very formal evaluation procedures. It's the responsibility of the board, the responsibility of senior management to say, hang on, let's look at the class that's being promoted to managing director. Gee, there's no women. There's no people of color. You, mid-level manager, go back and look. Go back and look at your ranks. You know, I don't believe quotas work in this country, because we're very quota-averse, but I think pressure works in saying, you know, you're managing director, you're presenting me the pool of people to be promoted. How come there's only white men in this mix? Go again and look harder. Now, if the people they find are not good enough, you don't want to promote them, because then you're just perpetuating something that's not going to work. But my experience has been that we all, and I see myself doing this, we tend to promote mini-me's. We tend to see excellence in people who look a lot like ourselves. We tend to like people who have similar backgrounds. So we all need to be pushed to be more diverse in the pool of people whom we see as high potential.
There's a, at the end of the book, one of your prescriptions is we'd be better off if we thought collaboratively rather than individually. And as I think about the overall setting the expectations, I can say, okay, fine, I'm going to change my expectations on what it is to be a wife, a mother, an employee. But then it feels like stepping out of the culture. It would be me against this sea of other expectations. How do you turn the tide? How do you get to a place where the expectation of what a woman should look like, how she should behave at work, what she should expect from her partner at home, what should make her kids say, you're a great mom. How do we move that ball?
It's hard. And this is where I always get in trouble with my books, because I'm always being pushed to, you know, come up with the five easy steps to make this happen. And I resist it, because I don't think there are five easy steps here. But I think there are 10 messy, complicated, long, boiling steps that we can take. And I think part of it is, as individuals, starting to tell a different message. You know, I think, and you know, I have a lucky position because I'm president of a women's college. You know, so I think in my life there are things I can do to say, you know, it's okay not to be perfect. I'm not. Let me actually show you how and why. And I don't think that means sort of saying, talking about the virtues of failure all the time. I think we've sort of overplayed that card. But just talking about the messiness of life. I think we need to drag men into these conversations. You know, again, when I've been giving these talks everywhere, there's not a lot of men in the room. And that's a problem. You know, we need to bring men into the room. Women need to, you know, both the literal and the figurative room. If men aren't part of this conversation, it's never going to change. So we need to drag our husbands in. We need to drag our bosses in. We need to push our sons in. We need to work both politically and communally. So part of the solution is better daycare, is better subsidized childcare. So I think we need to fight for those things politically. We need to enter the political process. And we also need to enter the community process. Because I think many of the problems that working parents face, not just working moms, is that the public school system still conspires against working parents. Somebody was just saying to me, this morning that, she had to leave because the school play that was supposed to happen yesterday was rescheduled for today. Well, that's death for the working parent. Put the school play on the calendar 6 months in advance. Have parent-teacher conferences at, times other than 11 in the morning. And these are things that I think if parents band together, it's not nasty. It's not about working mothers or working parents. It's how can we just make the schedule work better for parents of kids. So I think we have to do things personally in the terms of the stories we tell and the images we present. I think we need to work politically whenever we can, those of us who have those tendencies. We need to work communally. We need to drag men into this. And as parents, I think we also can try at least to send different messages to our kids. Make sure our boys do housework growing up. Make sure our daughters are not the ones who, have the responsibility of doing the cookie baking while their brothers are mowing the lawn. Try to start shifting those stereotypes as best we can.
All right, well, that concludes my conversation with Deborah. Now it's a chance for you all to get to ask questions, and I'm sure many people in this audience have some. So put your hands up, and there are people on each side with microphones. I see a hand right there next to you in the green sweater.
Good morning. Thank you. I agreed with much of what you said. One area in my life, I adopted a child as a single mother 20 years ago from China. When I was in a corporate job, and I found one of the most critical ingredients was the boss that I had through those 20 years. So in the beginning, I had a boss who was really very unsupportive. I had 40 business trips the first year. I took my daughter with me. I hired babysitters in the hotels. It was completely a process that, he was never bothered by. And but the second boss I had, I learned something from the first time around, and then I made it really explicit to say, look, don't worry, I have a toddler, but I will get this done. I will figure out how this will happen. And we had an incredibly rich, productive relationship for about 10 years. The third boss was someone who was a woman who had much different expectations about that, and I had to go through the same process. So I think if you could speak to the variables in terms of boss relationships and things that you've seen that have worked well and haven't worked well in that area, at least for me, that's been critical.
It's a great point. I thank you for bringing it up. I think there are always going to be some bosses who are better than others. So we can't change individual humans. But what I think we can do is, I always feel bad for sort of putting the burden on the woman, but I think part of it is being good enough at your job so that your boss is going to want you to succeed. And so that's always my advice to young women and young men. Start by being good, and putting yourself in a job where you can succeed, because that will give you the leverage. Once you have the leverage, I think it's important to say to the boss, here's what will help me succeed. Now, some of them may just be jerks and say, I don't care, these are the rules. But I think if a boss wants to keep an employee, it's very good for the employee to be able to say, this was what will work in my life. Because I think bosses oftentimes, and I can imagine in your situation, a single mom adopting a child, some people may just feel, ooh, this is a situation that's uncomfortable to me, I don't know how to deal with it, and so they don't do anything. Whereas if you say, look, this is what's going to help me, and you do it as nicely and politely and sort of well laid out as possible, I think that's really useful. I also think, and this is more of a wish, that one of the things that will really help is more men modeling this kind of behavior on their own. You know, men who are in positions of power saying, I am adopting a child. My partner and I are adopting a child. I'm you know, taking over the care of my elderly mother. And not doing it just as, you know, beating heart, you know, aren't I a good guy? But this is how I'm going to restructure my workplace for the next couple of years so that they're modeling that kind of behavior. And just to give you one, this is a tiny little anecdote, but I found it so wonderful to hear. I was talking to a young woman who just graduated from Harvard Law School. And she was talking about, all the third years are out doing their interviews for jobs after graduation, that the two highest ranked people in the class, and everybody always knows who they are, happened to be male in this year. And these young men made a point at every single interview to ask the law firms, so what's it like to be a parent here? And they did it so that their female classmates wouldn't have to do it. And I thought, kudos to them. And if, you know, if that's what we're seeing at least part of in the next generation, that's what will start to move the needle. So it doesn't all fall on the single mothers adopting children. You know, it's the young white guys who are in the position of strength asking the parenting questions.
Right there.
Good morning. Deborah, I haven't had the pleasure to read the book yet. I'm very excited to do so. My name's Grace Killalay. I own a Women's Leadership Institute. Two things. I'm interested in your perspective on aging. I'm 55, so I'm really seeing the impact on aging parents on the women that I lead, particularly because you spoke to a lot about women and children, but what we're seeing and what I'm seeing is the women that I work with are now being affected on by having their parents aging, and also on the effect of menopause, and also the effect on being a woman in her 50s and how corporations are looking at us differently. So your thoughts on that.
Thank you. It's a great question. The final chapter in the book is on aging. And I have to say it was the most poignant one for me to write and to research. I hadn't really thought about that aspect of the whole issue. And it's tough. You know, I think aging still falls harder on women than it does on men for a whole range of issues. One is that our culture is not kind to old women. We allow men to age gracefully, or at least we have a model of the white-haired, dapper, debonair, older man. There's not really a female equivalent, unless she's British. I think we allow British women to, like Judi Dench works. But, yeah. You know, you look in your profession, women on television are not allowed to age. I think it was Diane Sawyer who said recently, anchors don't get older, they just get blonder. But you're not allowed to have a wrinkle. Women of a certain age on the job market is very, very hard. One of my former colleagues was interviewing for jobs, and I remember her saying to me, you know, I know every guy interviewing me looks at me and I remind him of his ex-wife. And she wasn't getting jobs. So the job market is harder. The physicality is much harder. And I think, sadly, now we've extended our beauty norms. It used to be you just had to be beautiful between, like, 17 and 27. Then you had your kids and you were done. Now we're expected to look like we're 27 into our 80s. And if you look at, I did research on older models. You know, they're not old. They're in their 30s, and they've got, like, a little gray hair. And, you know, but they look like they're 27. And many of them are, and they're digitally, you know, photoshopped and digitally enhanced. And I think, you know, again, insofar as when we create the image of the woman, she's a fertile woman, she's in her childbearing years, I think menopause falls particularly hard, not just because of the physical attributes, but because it is the end of a woman's childbearing. So emotionally, it carries that additional baggage. And then you add, of course, the issues of taking care of elderly parents, often at the same time you're taking care of children. So, I'm sorry, that's a very depressing answer to your story. But I think, and this is, I do end the book on a note of optimism, where I reimagine what the Charlie commercial might look like in a more confident, secure, and sane universe. I think we need to create new images of the happily aging, you know, the woman in her 60s and 70s, who's found peace with herself, who's building a life that matters, who's surrounded by love in whatever form it takes. And I think we have enough critical mass among us baby boomers who are getting old, even if we don't want to acknowledge it, that hopefully we will start to create some of those more mature and you know, old role models.
Let's see, we've had some from the sides. We'll go down here in the middle. You guys, it's a toss up, the lady in pink and the lady in green.
Thank you. How do we get out of the diversity ghetto? And what I mean by that is, you know, many of us in our organizations, you know, our professional organizations and other things we're involved in, we're still fighting the good fight. But, I mean, I've had the experience on a board where I'm the chair of a very important substantive committee, having someone higher up the chain pull me aside and say, you know, you really need to stop harping on the woman and people of color thing, because it's affecting your effectiveness on this board.
And I'm actually going to follow up, because we're both complex commercial litigators, and we're both mothers, we're both spouses, and I think we both decided that perfection is not something we need to achieve. I think we decided that a long, long time ago.
Good for you.
The concern is that in our environments, we both fight for women, and we both participate in conversations like this, but there are very few guys, if any guys here.
There's a couple, brave
okay,
ones,
a couple.
In the back.
I went to a sponsoring versus mentoring talk yesterday. There were no guys. And the concern is, yes, you have to get men involved in the conversation, but in our world, they really don't want to be involved in the conversation, and they want to talk about men and women in law firms in different ways, and they really don't see why they need to change. So the question is, how do you get them involved?
How do you get there? Yelling, pushing, and screaming. You know, I mean, I've reached a point now where if I'm asked to have a conversation with the corporation on these issues, I won't do it unless they promise me that the CEO is going to be there, and that the senior men are going to be there. You know, now you have to have a certain amount of leverage to make demands like that, but I think the more of us who do that, slowly, messily, we may be able to achieve something. Because, you know, you used a word, I've gotten in trouble for using it, but I think it is the right word. I'm sorry, you used it. You know, the diversity ghetto is a real problem. If the only people who talk about diversity are women and people of color, we're going to remain ghettoized. And, you know, I think we have to, you know, hopefully there are men who get it, and I've certainly known enough of them who want to be in those rooms. But if they don't want to be there, I think we have to say to them, guys, you have a problem, and you cannot solve it by just letting the women's network take care of it. You've got to own this problem, and you've got to address it. We have to give the mic to my friend Connie Williams here.
Thank you, Deborah. I think that there's another option for women. And speaking from the, you said there's really no country for old women. There is. There's a big country. And I think one of the great opportunities for women is the fact that they could run for office.
Yes.
I ran for office when my children went to college. I took plateau years when they were growing up. So I read your book. I said, oh, yes, this is what I did. Mm-hmm. And we are looking for women who have done something in their lives with their career, their community, have launched children, and now have an opportunity to be at the table. Because as somebody said, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. We need more.
That's great.
We need more women in office, in leadership, in roles of power, and that's really how we're going to be able to change things. So thank you for your book.
And I think you're exactly right. And I was talking about this the other day. It's sort of, if you will, the Nancy Pelosi model. You know, we forget Nancy Pelosi took, I don't know how many years off to raise kids, but it was a lot. And running for office is something you can do after you've raised your kids. I think it's something that, you know, people can keep involved with the community, with the school board, while their kids are growing up. I've had two of my friends from college run for office in the last year. And I think it's a very powerful model. And we're starting to see slowly in Congress, although there's not much getting done, although today was a better day out of Washington, a lot of the bipartisanship in Washington is being pushed by women. And, you know, any of the female senators I've been lucky enough to, you know, have a quick chat with, I always ask them this question. And they all say that the women do a better job of reaching across the aisle because their focus is on getting stuff done rather than standing in philosophical isolation. That's a gendered statement, but it seems thus far to be true, and it's really powerful. So, yes, it's a really important model, and it's something we need to talk up to young women. Because one of my big fears right now is that the generation that's coming of age has come of age when politics has not been a very attractive field. And I really worry that a lot of young folks are going, why would I want to run for office? It's sleazy, it's yucky, and we're going to lose this generation. And that really scares me.
Let's go to the back there. This lady has had her hand up for a while.
Hi, thanks so much for your work. My name is Janet Benton. I'm a writer and editor. And one of my concerns in my own career has been making sure that I don't give short shrift to my daughter. I had a very active feminist mom and definitely got the short shrift. Mm-hmm. And so I really do understand how important mundane care is to children and mundane care provided by someone who loves them. And this is obviously the territory that Anne-Marie Slaughter was talking about, too, in her Atlantic piece. If you had a... I don't know if this is something you have at the ready or not, and you know any thoughts you have on it, I'd be interested in. But obviously, the United States has a shameful record of offering support for parents in their children's early years. Do you have a fantasy program or you know anything you really see as especially crucial in this area?
Yeah, I mean, I do, and some of it is fantasy, but some of it's not that hard to imagine. I think there are things we could do at the political level to make childcare easier and more affordable. You know, part of it is subsidized daycare like all of Scandinavia has. You know, that's sort of the easiest solution to imagine. Sadly, I don't see that coming down the pike, but I'll put that out there in fantasy land. But you could also imagine, you know, one of the reasons, not the only one, but one of the reasons corporations and organizations don't have better in-house daycare facilities is that regulatorily, it's very, very hard to do that. And I know we tried to do this at Harvard, and as soon as you set up a daycare facility on campus, you become a daycare provider, and you're subject to all kinds of licensing, which is very, very hard to comply with. So I think many organizations sort of say, it's too difficult. Those are regulations that could be changed. And yet I've seen very little political activity around that. We also could ease the tax code. You know, if any of you have filled out the forms, you know, if you want to pay your nanny a living wage and give her or him Social Security benefits, it's days of paperwork. You know, could we ease that so that it was it'd be easier to make nannydom a good, safe career for those of us able to afford nannies? We could also change immigration policy. I mean, one of the reasons that it's easier for women to be working in places like Hong Kong is that there's a large pool of daycare workers. Now, these are not particularly well-paid individuals, but we have a lot of political action right now in this country about getting immigration into the high-tech sphere. How about certain immigration programs for au pairs, nannies, that were safe, secure, you know, well-paid? We have none of those things going on. So some of that's a little bit of fantasy, but not that much.
More questions?
Yeah, a couple down.
Okay.
I want to offer another option. Like Connie, I have another option. A lot of women are fleeing the corporate world to start their own businesses. Some of them are lifestyle businesses. By the way, I'm Linda Resnick. And some of them are really trying to make fast growth businesses like their peer, male peers. Have you done any research or any thought on how to handle that and manage the full range of our lives?
Right. So it's a great option, and we are seeing a lot of women go into entrepreneurial fields. That's the good news. The bad news is that a shockingly small number of them have managed to grow their businesses to any kind of scale. And some of that may be that they're not aiming for scale, you know, they're doing small businesses, but getting venture funding as a woman is sort of disastrously hard. And there are a number of organizations, Golden Seeds, there's a few others that are networks of women trying to invest in women-owned businesses, but they're small. So we have to attack the financing piece much more actively than we have thus far, because otherwise I do worry that, you know, we're going to see women entrepreneurs as sort of cute, quaint quilters. Not that there's anything wrong with quilting. You know, rather than seeing women entrepreneurs the same way we think about, you know, male startups. So we have to attack the financing piece, which would be an interesting option for some of the big banks. Goldman is financing a lot of women entrepreneurs, but interestingly, mostly outside the United States.
Back there, the hand.
Good morning. My name is Kristen Hayduck. I want to take advantage of this opportunity to get your experience and those in the room. I'm a military veteran. I'm a technology consultant at a Big Four accounting firm. I'm engaged to be married, and I'll be 30 next month. What is a piece of advice that you have that you've seen women in my position go wrong and go right?
Ooh, good, tough question. Well, I think you've done a lot of the right part already. You know, I think, and at the risk of repeating myself here, I think the biggest mistake I see women making is taking on more than they should. And that, I'm not saying lean out, opt out, give up. I'm just saying be realistic. You know, if you're going to stay in the workforce and nurture a marriage and maybe have kids, you're going to have to take a lot of other stuff off your plate. And I think where I've struggled the most and where I've seen hundreds of women struggle is we're all fine at saying no to the stuff we don't want to do. We have to learn to say no to the stuff that we do want to do. And I've been saying very frequently to my young students, every time you say yes to something, you have to say no to something else. Because if you try to say yes to everything, you're going to do a bad job. You just are. And so you've got to get comfortable saying no. And something that it's taken me years to figure this out, it's actually easier to say no than it is to say maybe. I see people saying maybe all the time. Okay, I'll try to come. You know, I'll try to be there. That's where you get into trouble, because then it actually winds up taking you longer to get out of it. Now you feel guilty because you have strung people along, and you've created much more of a problem. If you say no up front, you know, the world goes on. They'll find someone else. It's when you say maybe that you run into trouble.
Right. Okay. This lady's been waiting right there in the middle. Let's go to her.
And don't do too much housework. Outsource whatever you can.
Yes.
Outsource.
Yes.
Once upon a time, job sharing was talked about as a possible way to get more flexibility in the workplace for people, mostly women. Where do companies stand on that now? You don't hear much about it.
It's disappeared. Oh. It's disappeared. And I think, just to answer a question you didn't ask, but just to segue into it, I think we need to be a little bit more explicit. When we're talking about women in the workforce, we're really talking about two very different categories. You know, most of the books are talking, including mine, are talking about women at the tippy top of the workforce. You know, if you want to be running a foundation or a Silicon Valley startup or a college, there is no job sharing. These are full-time, 24/7, all-out jobs. And I think we're creating a myth if we believe there's any potential of work sharing. If you're talking more about the blue-collar or the pink-collar workforce, there is much greater possibility for job sharing. And I think we need to be explicit in talking about that, because the solutions that are going to work for women who are aiming for the really tippy-top jobs are not the ones that are going to work for women more in the pink-collar, blue-collar workforce. And I think we need to grapple with that. And I think many of us who are sort of in the more elite sectors, we want to do kumbaya all the time, and it's actually not that helpful, because job sharing can work for executive assistants, for more entry-level, mid-level positions, but it's never going to work in the super fast track.
Last question.
All right. Last question. I guess I'm asking you from the point of view of your hat as president of Barnard. So I'd like to jump into a different sector, which is the nonprofit sector, and I run an arts organization. And so it's actually a slightly different ballpark where our board are mostly women. My employees are mostly women. The leaders in the organization are mostly women. A lot of them are young women. And as someone with a three-year-old and having 127 employees, what can I or other women do when those factors are in the right place to make it better for women?
Okay, so a good question. I think part, and this is a tough one to say. I think in an ideal world, we would have fewer organizations run entirely by men or entirely by women. So I think one of the things I've tried to do at Barnard is I've tried to bring more men into the college, on the board, in senior staff positions, because I think it's a learning experience for them. No, I really do. And I've had male board members say to me they actually never understood what it was like to be a woman until they were on the board, because all of a sudden they were the visible minority all the time. So I think it is good. I mean, if we really believe in diversity, so I would urge you to, you know, try and get some men involved too, because they'll take that experience and move out with them. Because I'd hate to see us devolve to a world where sort of all of the for-profit corporations are run by men and all of the nonprofit work is done by women. So I think we want to try and get that mix. But having said that, I think coming up with some of the things we were talking about earlier, you know, if you have employees with young kids, sit them down and say, how can I make this work for you? You don't want to have 100 different models, but I think you discover there's sort of two or three patterns. How do you make sure that you're being really equitable? Because one of the things we haven't talked about is I've heard a lot of complaints from women without children who say the women with children get helped, so I'm the one who's got to do extra because they get to go home with their kids, but I don't get to go out and date, and I'm never going to have a chance of having kids if I can't go to the bar every once in a while. And so I think you need to be careful not to create privileged categories of employees, but really figuring out what are a couple of models, whether it's, you know, Fridays off or everybody gets 3 hours a week to buy socks for their kids or go to the dentist or do whatever they have to do. I think if you talk to people and really figure out what will help make their lives easier, not only parents, but people with, you know, older parents, health issues, and make that part of the conversation without becoming too accommodating, I think you really can create, you know, sort of a model workplace.
Well, you've been great. You all Thanks. Have been great. I hope that you got a lot out of this morning, and I really appreciate you coming out. So let's give Deborah a round of applause.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.